Welcome to Catholic Morality and the Catechism. Monsignor William Smith talks about things our society would sometimes rather not discuss. Moral conscience, virtues, and the Ten Commandments. Here's Monsignor Smith.
Hello again, I'm Monsignor Smith. I teach moral theology at St. Joseph's Seminary, Dunwoody, which is the seminary for the Archdiocese of New York. In this series, we have been examining the moral teaching of the Church as it's contained and presented in this Catechism of the Catholic Church, Part 3. At first, we looked at some fundamentals. Then, one by one, we've been looking at the specifics and the order that they're presented, which is the order of the commandments. The last time, we began a consideration of the fifth commandment, at least in its negative acceptation, in its negative part, namely, a direct lethal assault on a moral innocent. Therefore, especially direct abortion, direct infanticide, direct euthanasia. This gets coordinated with the Holy Father's encyclical, The Gospel of Life, which came out after this, and I think the two should really be read together. And there is a positive part of the Fifth Commandment, but the Catechism makes a rather important insertion here as kind of a transition. It takes up the question of scandal in 2284. Scandal. Normally, we think of scandal as kind of a sin against or an obstacle to charity. But scandal is so important because it really is the death of God's life in us. It's a killer of grace. It's a killer of good example. It's taken with such seriousness with the authors of the Catechism that it's put under and within the fifth commandment. Now, what is scandal? Some people think scandal is like shock or surprise. Technically, theologically, particularly the Bible teaches it, it's any word, deed, or omission which is evil or has the appearance of evil and is likely to cause or contribute to the downfall of others. That's the particularly lethal aspect of scandal. True charity means to live for others, to help others, to be a helper of others. Scandal is that type of stumbling block where we lead someone astray, where our bad example, our bad encouragement, our bad work really leads someone in the wrong direction. And that's why Holy Scripture condemns this very. Some of the commentaries kind of try to water it down. But if you remember, Jesus in his own teaching was rather adamant in Matthew 18 about those who led the little ones astray, they'd be better off with a giant millstone fastened around their neck and dropped in the sea. If you want to check a biblical dictionary, millstones are very heavy. So he takes it as a very grave thing. Scandal, which is not, I know some people get very blasé and they'll say, nothing scandalizes me. Well, not that much edifies me either. Now, you can have it in our laws, you can have it in our institutions, you can have it in fashions. There's certainly a decline in morals. Those who make it difficult or practically impossible to live the Ten Commandments are causing scandal. Some businessmen or leaders make rules that even encourage fraud. Things of that nature are either evil or have the appearance of evil, and they really make a stumbling block for others. If, as St. Paul says, we're supposed to live for others, then we shouldn't put stumbling blocks that make it more difficult for others to live as a Christian. The Lord Jesus teaches in Luke 17, says very clearly, temptations are sure to come, but woe to him by whom they come. Therefore, woe to the one who gives the bad example, who causes the scandal. And it's considered so serious a thing, scandal, that it's actually put under the rubric of the Fifth Commandment. It's kind of a transition. We said you can look at the Fifth Commandment positively, never directly take the life of an innocent, negatively, never take the life of an innocent, but positively, there is as well a positive obligation to take care of our health, our life, and our bodily integrity, and to do that within reasonable and proportionate limits. So there is a genuine concern for health. which is not really just an option, but it really is an obligation. 2289 in the Catechism reminds us we're not into any kind of neo-pagan worship of the body or the cult of the body, but we have a responsibility. If life is a gift, we say it is a gift from God, well then health too is a corresponding gift. It's a stewardship, it's a trusteeship for which we are responsible. So under the rubric of the virtue of temperance in 2290, it says that the Catechism teaches we should avoid every kind of excess, the abuse of food, alcohol, tobacco, or medicine. The abuse of food, alcohol, tobacco, or medicine. They encourage grave guilt who, by drunkenness or love of speed, recklessly endanger the life of others. There's a quiet little part of that number 2290 which deserves a little expansion in our society, and I think it's the abuse of alcohol. Alcohol. C2H5OH. C2H5OH is ethyl alcohol. That is the most abused drug in our society. It's usually the drug of first abuse as well. Now, we are not Mohammedans. We are not perfect teetotalers. We realize that in most cultures, alcohol can be considered a legitimate food, for instance, in wine or what have you. But its responsible use and its abuse, it may well be the largest pastoral moral problem or the cause of moral problems in our country. The next time you go down to renew your driver's license and the state gives out some of that information, read some of that information. Something like 50% of all the traffic fatalities in the United States have some connection with someone abusing alcohol. Most of your local jails, someone was abusing alcohol. 72% of all the people who drown in the United States, they drown not because they can't swim, some of them can, but they've been drinking and can't swim, and that's why they drown. All sorts of family problems are caused by the abuse of alcohol. Again, we are not Mohammedans, we are not teetotalers, the Catholic Church does not teach that this is intrinsically evil, but as a matter of fact, something like 5% of our population is alcoholic. 5%, that's 5% of 260 million people. That means not just the people who have a few drinks or like to have a couple of drinks, but they can't really touch it at all. And we are told that their lives affect four other people in any given day. So we're talking about almost 40 million people whose lives can be upset or worried about whether someone's coming home or whether they show up for work. And all of this has to do really with the abuse of alcohol. Again, we're not against its use or its existence, but its misuse causes many family problems and many pastoral problems. And we would just wish that we could kind of reach the state that all the people who say they could take it or leave it could kind of live out that, take it or leave it, take it or leave it. Well, every now and then someone should leave it. Because if you can't leave anything alone for about 2 weeks, it's got you. You don't have it, and you don't have it under control. In the old Lenten program, when people used to give up drinking for Lent and use the money for some charitable purpose, it's not a bad program. It makes sense. What you give up, you freely give away. And it makes perfect sense. Same thing with the use of medicine. In fact, 2291 speaks about the use of drugs. And here we have to make a distinction about the medical use of drugs and the recreational use of drugs. Now, some people say, well, the older generation, my parents, they drank a lot. I'm not into that, so I can play with my favorite chemistry. That is foolish advice. That is foolish advice, and it shouldn't be followed. If there's a strictly therapeutic reason for using a drug under some kind of medical direction, fine. All progress in that direction is welcome. But if it's just mind-altering or trying to escape from reality, then that really is not a moral exercise of human responsibility. The best advice to that person is not to say, well, it doesn't matter in comparison to something else. That's not good advice. The best advice to anyone who's out of contact with reality is to get them back into contact with reality so that they too can make some progress in virtue. The next section concerns what they call respect for the human person and scientific research, numbers 2292 through numbers 2296. Now here, there's a very important distinction. Actually, if you hear that term, respect for the human person, remember, human life is sacred. Human life is sacred. That's the gold bar standard that runs through this whole thing. Where science is concerned and research is concerned, Cardinal Ratzinger, nor myself, nor anyone else, we're not running to be the president of the Flat Earth Society. We don't oppose science, but we make distinctions. Science is to serve the human person. Science is to serve man. Man is not here to serve science as a guinea pig, as an experimentation, or in any unconsenting experimentation. So we distinguish what we call a therapeutic use and a non-therapeutic use. If you're trying to serve human beings, it would be absurd to say that you take the ethics of a science merely from the data of the science. I mean, you could take all the components of a car, four wheels, two windshield wipers, a carburetor, an engine, you have all those parts. You tell me from the data what's the right way to drive a car. You can't even figure out which is the right side of the road to drive on merely from the data. Well, so it is with the data of modern research. You have to bring that vision of the human purpose, the vision of the human person, their vocation, their eternal worth and design. That's what we bring to any science, to make sure that the science serves the human person and not the other way around. After all, we have been given dominion over nature, not the other way around, and we shouldn't approach things with blinders on it. Therefore, in 2295, it says, research and experimentation on a human being cannot be legitimate if this involves things that are really contrary to the dignity of that human person. So we can take some risks, actually, if it's therapeutic, if it's curing something, even if it's an experimental drug and you have this disease and you've taken the normal methodologies and they haven't worked and there's this thing that may work, may not. If you really have the disease, that could be a legitimate therapeutic use. But to inflict those things on someone who doesn't have the disease at all, simply to learn what you can learn, that's non-therapeutic and that's a different ball of wax. And obviously that would never be right, 2295 says, without the informed consent of the individual. And of course, if it's really lethal, then even the informed consent is not enough, because you can't give informed consent to your own destruction. 2296 mentions organ transplants. Now, for whatever reason, some Catholics seem to think the Church opposes that, and the Church does not oppose organ transplants, but it puts down certain conditions, two conditions, which go back again to Pope Pius XII. Many of the things in medical ethics go back to the precision and the teaching of Pope Pius XII. That too is referred to in the ethical directives for Catholic health facilities, as well as this little charter for healthcare workers that came from the Vatican. It serves as almost a little vade mecum for medical ethics questions. Obviously, given the size of this, it runs some 150 numbers. Because it's just limited to medical ethics, it's much more of an expansion than the few paragraphs that we find here. But where organ transplants are concerned, if it's a matter of what we call a cadaver transplant, a post-mortem, you have to have two things. You have to have the consent of the person prior to their death or after, the nearest of kin, and we ask that the remains of a human being be treated with respect that's consonant with what used to be a temple of the Holy Ghost. Okay, so genuine consent and respect for the mean. No one has to do this, but if they wish to, they are free to, as long as those parameters are mentioned. Oddly, or perhaps significantly, in the encyclical Evangelium Vitae, in number 86, the Holy Father, John Paul II, calls a praiseworthy contribution to the culture of life of those who make the donation of organs. But he puts in the caution in number 15, that particularly with the little ones and with others, we shouldn't hurry up the criteria or hurry up the definition of death in order to bring this. So it has to be made a judgment if someone makes a postmortem donation. Postmortem means after death. not ante-mortem, not before, not as if you're almost dead, but after true death, then there's a cadaver transplant. Even transplants among the living of a non-vital organ are possible. But again, the consent of the person and respect for their bodily integrity. But the church leaves that as an extraordinary thing. Therefore, it's a choice. It's an option. No one has to do it. But if they choose to do it, it can be good. It can, according to the Holy Father, even be praiseworthy. Now, respect about the bodily person in 2297, things like kidnapping and hostage taking and terrorism and torture are brought up, and they are thoroughly condemned because they are such a gross violation of the dignity of a human being to treat them as a thing and just overpower someone and use them as a bargaining tool, a bargaining chip to bring about some political agenda or other agenda. Anytime you use a human being as a mere means, as a mere thing, you are doing disrespect to the one who's made in the image and likeness of God. And in fact, there's probably a unique apology in the next section of the Catechism in 2298. It says, in times past, cruel practices were commonly used by legitimate governments to maintain law and order, often without protest from the pastors of the church, who themselves adopted in their own tribunals the prescriptions of Roman law, sometimes including torture. And they apologize for that, that was a wrong understanding that was employed in the Middle Ages and a time after, and is not to be justified today. In fact, probably more than the mention of the natural law in the moral part of the Catechism is much more the emphasis, the John Paul II emphasis, on the respect for the dignity of the individual. The dignity of the individual. All individuals, no matter what they believe, but all of those individuals were made in the image and likeness of God. Lastly, it touches on the, last in the sixth, this quadrant, is that it touches on respect for the dead. It mentions in 2301 that the church has no objection to autopsies. Some religions do, ours do not. Where that's really necessary and where it's useful, it has to be done in a criminal procedure. And even the permission to use cremation if people are not doing that for the right reasons and not as some kind of anti-religious motive. So the negative part, don't directly kill the innocent. The positive part, we have an obligation, not an option, to take care of our life, our health, and our bodily integrity, and that admits proportionate limits. And the last segment, which I suppose you could say really belongs up in the front, but it has to do with safeguarding the peace. It comes down to questions of peace and war. And what you have here really is a presentation of that section of Gaudium et Spes, the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world from the Second Vatican Council. And the teaching of the so-called just war theory is explained here. That goes all the way back in its primitive form, in the smallest outline, I suppose, to what you will find in St. Augustine's famous book, In the City of God. And that was outlined with a little bit more refinement well over 1,000 years later. Well, if Augustine died in the year 430, St. Thomas died in the year 1274, and St. Thomas in his Summa also outlined the notion of the just war theory. And then that held, widely adhered to, at least in Christian nations. But the fathers of the council back in 1962 to 1965 had to face some modern questions that some of the ancients really never had to face, because we like to think that everybody was kind of unenlightened until we came along. But if you're honest about it, if you're really honest about it, our 20th century is the century that killed the most people. At the beginning of the 20th century, for every 10 soldiers that died, one civilian was killed. By the end of the Second World War, for every soldier that was killed, 10 civilians were killed. And weapons of mass destruction, total war, total mobilization, this changed the nature of many, many things. And this is why the fathers of the council sat down soberly. Remember, they were all in their adult years during the graphic, tragic circumstances of the Second World War. So, and it was still fresh in their minds, and they took the traditional criteria of the just war theory, and they tested it, they sampled it, and they came out with a very modern, responsible, contemporary statement of the same tradition, but enlightened and opened to some technological questions that had not really come up before. And remember, they go back to the famous definition of peace. They take it from St. Augustine on the tranquility of order. Peace is not just the absence of war. You can have an absence of war in a concentration camp. You can have law and order in a concentration camp. But when people's fundamental rights are denied and you just keep the place quiet, if you want to call that peace, you're talking about an empty shell. We also want to be careful when we read through this, because some people have proposed what they call an ethic of nonviolence, and they say, well, reason forbids the use of violence. Well, that's true if, of course, your definition of violence is unreasonable force. What our Catholic tradition normally does is to make a distinction between just use of force and the unjust use of force. Force is a less charged word. Is there unjust force? Sure. Even the police and soldiers. I mean, once you got someone locked up, if you start beating on their head, my goodness, that's an unjust use of force. Parents can use a little force, a little pressure to discipline their children. You start beating them up, they call that child abuse. So there is a legitimate distinction here, and it's one that the Church respects. So she respects with great seriousness the obligation to avoid war. We don't want to romanticize it. Most of what we know about wars comes from Hollywood. That's La La Land. They have their reasons for depicting things in a certain way. But in modern circumstances, modern wars are horrible. And lots of innocent people get hurt and they get killed. But beginning there, in number 2309, they outline the standard conditions of the just war, so to speak. And these are, basically, the cause has to be just. It truly has to be a last resort. It's not a first resort. It's after all peaceful and legal means have been exhausted. Really try to solve it. Really try to solve it, and it can't work. It has to be a just war of defense, not aggression. Since the Second Vatican Council, we cannot speak of a just war of aggression. But when the rights of some people, some country, their basic rights are being gravely violated, and there's an unjust aggressor causing that, that could be a just cause, a last resort. There has to be some hope of success. You might read of the charge of the Light Brigade. It makes for lovely poetry, but it's disastrous military tactics. When all 600 people get killed, that's not a successful adventure. And if you only make the situation worse than the beginning, that's not the way to do it. It has to be called by the competent authority. Not every hothead in society can go around committing society to a collective self-defense. And it says at the end of 2309, these are the traditional elements which are enumerated as the so-called just war doctrine. And on a case-by-case basis, we try to see, we use the brains God gave us to see whether these causes, these conditions are really fulfilled. If so, then that can justify the legitimate use of force to repel an unjust aggressor. If not, it would be a wrongful use. At the same time, being a realistic document, the Catechism repeats what the Council taught. Public authorities do have the right and the duty to impose on citizens obligations of national defense. So if it is a just cause, and if it is the last resort, and if there is some probability of success, if these things are in place, and all of us have an obligation to support a just cause. It says in 2311 what the Council taught, public authorities should try to make some provision for people who, for reasons of conscience, feel that they cannot participate at all in the use of arms or the use of force, but they must be willing to provide some other service to the human community. Maybe it's medical service, maybe it's farming service, but some other. The Catholic understanding takes these things seriously, so it's not just some kind of a free ride. But if someone really in conscience cannot do this or feel they can't, they should make some other contribution to the human community. But even if those conditions of just war are met, that doesn't mean any and every action in a just war is justified. And that's why we have to keep that condition, that distinction between combatants and non-combatants, that the force should be directed toward military targets. Sometimes we foresee ancillary consequences. And it repeats the condemnation, and one of the only absolute condemnations of the Second Vatican Council in 23:14. Every act of war directed indiscriminately at the destruction of whole cities together with their population is offense against God or man. If you add it all up, there's a consistency through this fifth commandment. We go back to the respectfulness of the sacredness of human life. Every blessed one of us is made in the image and likeness of God. We have to respect that through certain negative prohibitions, but also through certain positive affirmations, and try not to neglect that. It's when people use funny terminology to call things that they are not that we end up disrespecting the sacredness of this human life. Do all the things that positively enhance it. Negatively, we discourage anything that is against it, but to respect over and over every single creature made in the image and likeness of our God.
Join us again next time for Catholic Morality and the Catechism on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.